Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. Okay, our first article is entitled Darkness. The darkness blew my mind. Embarking on a unique personal challenge, 82 hours without light, inside the sensory equivalent of a tomb, Tim Neville takes a trippy ride into a dream world where nothing is everything. The darkness has a name, but I don't know that yet. All I know is that I'm scared. I'm sitting with my feet in a creek in the scrubby mountains southeast of Ashland, Oregon, watching how the water spills over gray rocks into a shallow pool. All day long, I've been alone and unplugged, doing my best to savor moments like this one. I note how the sunlight flickers through the black oaks and flickers in the water like coins in a fountain. Colors get special attention. The denim blue lupines, the amber grass, and the plum-colored mountains around me. I squirrel these images away to return to later, like nuts before winter. A forgettable dirt road follows the creek out of Cascade Siskiyou National Monument, which surrounds this place, but that's as much as I'll say about the location. A lot of famous people keen on their privacy come up this way, but even plebs like me are welcome. Once you're here, you have to become no one anyway, in a metaphorical sense, which doesn't feel metaphorical at all. You must be ready to be buried alive. I walk slowly, deliberately, uphill to a small clearing ringed by aspen and oak. The anxiety that's been rising, my lungs turn steely and sharp when I see a pale wooden door built into a hillside, framed by lava rock. It looks like the entrance to Bilbo Baggins' house. I go in. A stairway tumbles down to a windowless 300-square-foot room with textured walls, a bathroom, and a wooden bed that smells like sage. A single low wattage bulb hums faintly overhead. It's controlled by a switch covered with a hard plastic guard, which makes it difficult to turn off and on. That's the point. This room and two others like it in these secret woodlands are the heart of what might be the country's only established commercial dark retreat. This is a spiritual place where visitors pay good money to spend long periods of time in crypt-like blackness, devoid of all light and most sounds, in an attempt to uncage their minds, and they hope to discover something deeper within. I'm here to give it a shot, but the mere thought has left my hands clammy and my breathing pinched. I flip the switch to see just how dark the dark is, and terror presses into me like 13,000 vertical feet of seawater. I implode and race outside, gasping. All humans know the feeling. This isn't the dark of the inside of a tent on a moonless night when the forest sways in purple starlight, nor is it a creepy basement where a thin ribbon of light can weasel under the door. You can feel this kind of dark at a place like Carlsbad Cavern, where 830 feet under the New Mexican desert, the rangers turn off the lights and let the children scream. It's that kind that triggers that some atavistic line of code that sends your amygdala ragdolling over evolution's awful ledges. How can I survive this? How can I escape it? And the worst, what else is in here, and is it hungry? Evening comes, time to be brave. I take one last look around outside and gather a few more nuts. A mountain chickadee twitters about, deer slip through the grass. I go inside and seal myself into the room with a few necessities I'll be able to locate by touch. A toothbrush, a hydro flask, a gray cotton onesie my wife got me for Christmas because of the way it feels and smells. Two senses the dark can't steal. I light a small candle and turn off the overhead light, hoping to feel a sense of control for one last minute. You can do this. I blow out the candle and swallow the panic as the enormity of the situation settles in. My eyes will never adjust to this. Today is Sunday. It'll be Thursday before I see a single photon again. That's 82 hours, alone, in the absolute absence of light. I can't think about any of that now. Instead, I go to bed early and pretend everything is all right. But it isn't. Things are about to get really, really weird. I first heard about dark retreats one night, just before bed while mindlessly scrolling through videos online. A place in southern Oregon called Sky Cave had posted clips featuring squinty-eyed guests returning to the sunlight after anywhere from 1 to 40 days in the dark. You could not watch them. After they adjusted to the nuclear blast of sunlight, they spoke with gratitude and marveled at how detailed the world looked. Many of them sobbed like castaways realizing that their rescue was real. There's no familiar orientation for it to do with this, a barefoot guy in a purple v-neck said in one video. It's like being born. Shameless rubbernecking at vulnerable strangers was entertaining, yes, but it was also moving. They seemed genuinely transformed by an experience that teetered on cruel and unusual. Many spoke of the dark as if it were a living, breathing, beneficent thing. It had taught them how to forgive or how to love. Others spoke of a great shedding of who they thought they were, an even greater rebuilding of who they knew they could be. The mix was intriguing. Imagine the profound relief of a mountaineer just off a near-disastrous ascent, combined with the lyrical rapture of an astronaut back from space. A Google search seemed to show that Sky Cave was the only commercial dark retreat in the country, with a website at least. Though I later heard rumors of informal ones in, as in, this dude has a room in Colorado, Guatemala has a dark retreat, as does Germany, where podcaster Aubrey Marcus went to produce a documentary, Awake in the Darkness, to help put the practice on the modern map. The Shucks have embraced the concept by creating dozens of dark retreats, many of them connected with hospitals, helping people overcome depression, anxiety, and other issues. Little scientific evidence exists to support the notion that there are benefits to spending a long time in the dark. But the work is just beginning. The practice itself is ancient. 10th century Tibetan monks used the dark to attain a state of transitional consciousness. Among the Kogi people of Colombia, children chosen before birth to be priests have spent the first year of their lives in darkness as a way to connect with Aluna, nature's great mother. The most relevant study of the potential benefits of darkness I found came from a Swedish psychologist, Annette Kjellgren, at the Human Performance Laboratory at Karlstad University. Kjellgren surveyed healthy participants after they completed 12 sessions over 7 weeks, floating for 45 minutes inside a dark, silent tank of warm saline. The results were clear. In a paper published in BMC Complementary Medicine and Therapies in 2014, she argued that after the process, people, especially mindful people, meaning those open or receptive to what is happening in the present, experienced altered states of consciousness and reduced levels of stress, depression, and anxiety, while their optimism increased significantly. Perhaps unsurprisingly then, demand for the dark is growing. Sky Cave, which charges $250 a night, currently has only 3 rooms but plans to build 7 more, along with a 4,000 square foot lodge. The wait has grown to about 2 years. In February 2023, Sky Cave got its biggest boost to date when NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers revealed that he was going into the dark, in part to help him figure out his next career move. He didn't mention Sky Cave by name, but that's where he went. "It's 4 nights of complete darkness," Rogers explained to ESPN's Pat McAfee. "What?" McAfee replied. "You're going to Alaska?" "Beyond all reason, the thought of signing up for a stint in the abyss began to consume me. Every friend I ran the idea by shuddered in disbelief as if I were deciding which eye to poke out. 4 nights, 3 days, alone in the dark, no music, no phone. An eternity. I tried to remember what I'd been doing 3 days ago, but couldn't. It was already such a blur. Even stranger, I had no real reason to do this. No unhappy childhood to unpack. No PTSD to manage. No offers from the Jets. I struggle with anxiety and depression runs in the family. But neither to any degree that a good river trip can't fix. Deep down, I hope that the dark might help rekindle a sense of purpose left bruised and bloodied by the pandemic. I figured I could treat it to the way I treat travel to some of the difficult places my work has taken me. I would be curious and open, come what may. Doing that rarely leads to disappointment. I managed to book a slot and got ready to go. The whole idea stressed out my wife, Heidi. I'm not worried like I was when you went to North Korea, she said one night, citing other times I'd gone all in on unquestionable a quest. I'm worried you'll love it and black out the house. I think I've slept through my first night, but with no way to check the hour without exposing myself to light, I can't be sure. At first, losing all sense of time seemed terrifying, but now it's rather blissful. The uninterrupted, guilt-free rest feels like warm honey working its way into every achy, burned-out part of me. So I roll over and sleep some more. When I open my eyes, I just shut them again. The dark feels less scary that way. When finally I rise, I create a routine. I change into shorts, do some push-ups, and make the bed. All by feel. Learning to navigate the room boils down to touching things in a certain order. Bed, corner, doorway, takes me to the bathroom. Doorway, sink, wall, puts me on the final approach to the toilet. Sit, cuss, stand is how I remember to put the seat down. Breakfast. I feel my way over to the cushion on the floor next to a low wooden bench. Above it is a box built into the wall, linking the room to an outer vestibule. Doors on either side allow two-way access with no light coming through. For now, this box is my only link to the outside world. I can leave at any time, but I promise myself that I won't. I open the box and feel around for metal containers holding soup, salad, PB&J, carrots, hummus, olives, and more. Eating is something, anything to do, so I go slowly. I play with a hard-boiled egg, sliding it around the container like a slippery weeble. It's fun while it lasts. 15 minutes later, I have nothing to do again. The idea of being bored for 3+ days worried me, but surprisingly, it isn't really an issue. Boredom to me is having lots of things to do, none of which sound fun. In here, I can't even stare at the wall. So boredom becomes longing for sunlight, for mountain air, for interaction, and to long for is to dream. That's easy in here. Plus, I'm not truly alone. The day before I went dark, I met Scott Berman, who with his wife Jill started Sky Cave in 2020. He told me that every evening he would come and restock the food box and chat with me for a few minutes to check in. His main tips were to allow myself to become nobody and soften into the experience. When I asked for details, he put it more bluntly. It's like preparing for your deathbed. In other words, it's better to surrender and accept than to resist and suffer. Berman, who is 40, has a lean, muscular frame and has a big, bushy beard. He says that people who fight the darkness with spiritual tools like chanting or meditation often have a hard time. Eventually, they become exhausted. It's still dark. There's nothing to do but sit for hours and days. The dark is almost counter to counterculture, he says. You can't prop up your mind in there. Berman found this out some time ago. He grew up happy, the son of supportive parents in New Jersey, but a breakup in college sent him into a tailspin that morphed into an obsessive quest for spiritual fulfillment. He read Ram Dass and lived at Vipassana Meditation Center in Canada. He stayed alone in a cabin in Alaska in a canyon in Baja. He ran around Joshua Tree naked after dark and sang banged wildly on a drum at music festivals. Had no filter at all, he says. Once, he stood barefoot and shirtless outside New York's Grand Central Station, singing to the sun, until a policeman offered to find him mental health support. Or, I could just put on a shirt and stop being weird, Berman replied. Yeah, the officer said, let's do that. In 2006, Berman met Jill at a bluegrass festival, and 2 years later, they were inseparable. He'd sing and drum while she danced ecstatically. Around 2012, he started drifting back into mainstream society while working at a cannabis farm in southern Oregon. For the first time in years, Berman had money and began to yearn for more material things, he says, like nice dinner and energy crystals. About that time, they caught wind of a guy in Portland doing dark retreats, an idea that intrigued them. Instead of visiting his, they created their own by blocking out the windows of their rental home near Ashland. They stayed inside for 5 days. It wasn't great. When you do it with someone you know in your own house, there's so much familiarity around you, Berman says. So a few months later, he tried it again, this time alone, in Baja for a period of 10 days. He was completely floored by how challenging being alone in the pitch black with zero distractions was. I'm so happy when I'm in solitude in the woods, but that wasn't my experience here, he says. Still, I was moved by how sensitive and aware I became. The initial discomfort and the surrender to it slowly revealed the kernel of his authentic self, the one he'd been busy burying under piles of New Age spiritualities. All that nothingness stripped the constructs away. All I have to do is just be in the space, he says, meaning go deep and become more aware. I came out and I thought, I want to build a darkness retreat. 3 years after he opened Sky Cave, I'm here on the floor, sifting through memories. I'm five, riding with my mom in her Corvair. It's yesterday, and I'm sitting by a creek. I'm lying shirtless in bed, feeling my wife's breath as warm circles on my back. I do this for what feels like hours. Slowly, long pauses of nothing at all. No dreaming, no thinking, no focusing. Slip between my thoughts. That's when the hallucinations begin. At first, the visions are fun because they seem so real. I blink a dozen times to confirm that the room has indeed become a limestone cave illuminated by beams that shoot from my eyes. And the darkness is no longer monolithic, but swirls with shades of black and parade of textures. Meanwhile, my proprioceptive senses have gone haywire. I take a bath, and when the water cools, I can see my foot. Reach up to find the hot water faucet handle. I can't see any detail. My foot just looks like a darker, smoother patch of darkness. But there's no mistaking that it's there. As that first day drags on, the hallucinations become annoying. They all involve light, which makes me think that my eyes are short-circuiting from the lack of stimulation. I'm staring out imaginary windows at the Alps when a DJ flicks on strobe lights that burn into my retinas. Later, I'm fooling with another hard-boiled egg when a dude in a 30-cylinder truck drills his high beams into the side of my face. "Really, man?" I shout, but he doesn't reply. Berman comes, takes my dishes, and replenishes the food. His visits are the only way I know for sure that it's evening. We chat for a couple minutes. I tell him about the space that's opening up between the thoughts. He tells me the space is always there, and to think about it as a surface upon which life is imprinted. He asks me to ask myself, who's doing the thinking when a thought marches into that space? The question makes no sense. Of course it's me, I say. Who else would it be? Just explore it, he says, and in 10 minutes, he's gone. Knowing that all I have to do is eat and then I can go to bed to boost my spirits, but then I begin to ruminate over how much time I have left in here. Another night, another day, another night, another day, and another night. I stop thinking about that. It's like running. Better to enjoy the effort than to keep checking your watch. I sleep poorly that second night, but force myself to stay in bed for as long as I can to pass the time. When I grow so restless that my back begins to ache, I get up and do my routine. 10 minutes later, I'm lying on the floor daydreaming again. The space between thoughts has expanded to such a degree that I can float along in nothingness for hours without really trying. You only need a few hours in the dark to figure out what's important to you. After about 36 hours, the real work begins as the hallucinations become wild and unhinged. Yet all of them are deeply moving. Some make me laugh, some make me sob. Soon I'm visualizing past experiences in a way that makes me feel insane. All the moments of my life, hearing a song, ordering a chalupa, riding a chairlift, have become millions of small gelatinous cubes that I can physically hold and rearrange. And this nothingness, all those experiences have glommed onto each other to form, well, me, the product of everything I've ever interacted with. Some cubes are ugly and full of impatience, self-loathing, and jealousy, but in this dream state, it's easy to pluck them out of the pile and set them aside. When I come to, the darkness has shifted and now has a presence as if I'm not alone. But instead of terrifying me, the darkness feels strangely comforting. Berman arrives and I tell him about the wild ride I've been having. It's like I'm painting that hasn't been finished. I'm a painting that hasn't been finished. By the time I go to bed on day two, I tell myself that I'm ready to leave. I've come to terms with the dark. I've learned what's important. I feel no need to be impatient or jealous or mean again. But I stick it out and I'm glad. Day three is a doozy. With nothing to distinguish night and day, my circadian rhythm is fully whacked. Sleep comes in fits and starts, and time is meaningless. Long stretches pass when I am unaware of the lack of light. The blackness that once felt like a suffocating garbage bag is now the airy backdrop for my mental image of the room. The vision seems so real, as if I can look around and see the rub. See the tub, the box, the bench. Is this how bats experience the world? As a test, I reach out to grab the bed on the way back from the bathroom and miss it. The error makes me dizzy until finally I find the bed 2 feet away and the room snaps back into place. I do my routine but quickly make my way to a meditation corner where the room is cooler and somehow darker. I lie down in a fetal position and effortlessly conjure up that space between thoughts. It is a really weird thing to be so conscious of a thought-free place. As if thinking and not thinking are the same thing. Somehow it works, and this time I try to impregnate the space with declarations like, I am imperfect, and I am enough. The fact that I'm doing any of this, that I'm uttering these affirmations like a best life TikTok Ted Lasso, would make old me barf. But new me knows the benefits of playing along with an open mind. In practical terms, if nothing else, I have a much better sense than I used to of just how long a day is, and how much of that time I've been wasting. But the darkness isn't done. I'm busy filling the space with I am loved when a fight breaks out. Another thought, some scrawny Facebook argument, struts into the space demanding attention. I am too weak to ignore the intruder. What are you doing, I ask. You could have won that argument, it replies. I don't want to think about that, I say. The thought starts to utter a comeback, but I cut it off, yelling like a petulant child who's fighting over an open swing on the playground. Stop it, I say out loud. I was here first. That's all it takes, that simple affirmation of being first. The space between thoughts has been there since long before I had words and jelly cubes to fill it. And as soon as I acknowledge it, the void becomes unshackled and expands so violently that I can feel it filling me up from the inside. My toes tingle, my hands heat up. My chest is an orange too big for its peel. It is as if I've been an airless balloon all my life and the dark has just shown me how to inflate it. The nothing within and the nothing without are shaped by me, a thin rubbery shell. Maybe I'm going nuts, but the feeling is one of total fulfillment. I spend hours wallowing in an expanded space, no longer hungry, no longer tired. The space is infinite and edgeless, allows me to hold competing emotions freely. I can be sad and ecstatic, stressed and calm, angry and forgiving, all simultaneously. You're hogging the drive-thru. No worries, I can be impatient and happy to wait for you too. Janet, I say, talking to the dark, that's your name, isn't it? There's no reply, but I know I'm right. It's a fitting name, borrowed from Good Janet. The afterlife's all-knowing, all-giving, void-dwelling virtual assistant in NBC comedy, The Good Place. She, not a girl, has one last thing to show me. A little gelatinous cube hiding like a toy that I didn't even know I'd lost. I pick it up. It's different from the others. It's green with a dot on it. I sob uncontrollably when I realize that it's my sense of wonder. I sleep hard that last night, so hard that Berman has to bang on the door to tell me it's Thursday morning and time to come out. I get dressed and put on an eye mask to ease myself into the light. I went in scared. 82 hours later, I'm coming out terrified, because I know the feeling of fullness will fade under the weight of the world. I sit in an Adirondack chair by the Baggins door and remove the mask slowly. The light is far brighter than I ever could have imagined. I am raw and emotional. Myself now a reel for rubberneckers. In the coming weeks, the feeling of fullness does fade, but it's never entirely gone. Even 5 months later, I can still conjure it up on demand and feel it race around my limbs to inflate all that space within. It's not like I'm never angry or frustrated or anxious in my daily life anymore. Rather, I have room for those feelings to do their thing without crowding out everything else. And I got all that zen for the bargain price of just 3 days in the dark. My wife notices the change. I'm more tranquil, totally happy to sit alone without the urge to check my phone. I have no need for another retreat. The first day out, I raced back to Ben, ready to live, and that was all the purpose I needed. Heidi scored us Chris Stapleton tickets, the best re-entry gift ever, and that night I danced with 8,000 strangers in a seething mass awash in sound and lasers. No one could imagine where I'd been. I was just grateful for the light. That was by Tim Neville. It was 2023 Outside Feature, The Last Ride of a Legend, a pony who lived up to his name, won a gold award from the Society of American Travel Writers. And next up, we have Dispatches of the Debate. This time, it is buying new gear better than using old gear until it falls apart? One gear editor goes kiddo a mano with her dad. First off, your trustiest stuff deserves loyalty by Hugh Klein, former junior ski team parent. When it comes to gear, there's a saying that will always resonate. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Even better, if it is broke, fix it yourself. Why not duct tape your ski gloves once they sustain a few tears? If nothing else, mine are more waterproof now. If you have a ski with anything short of blown out edge, it's amazing what a good base grind and edge sharpening can do. When I freeheel away from lift-served terrain, I'm still using my ancient Telemark gear, 25-year-old K2 World Peace. They're wet noodles on hardpack, but work fine in backcountry snow. You can save a ton of money rescuing old gear from local shops, and someone please tell me why my poles need to match. As long as they're about the same weight, who cares? Last time I snapped a pole, I went to the closest ski shop, fished one out of the trash, cut it to size with a hacksaw, and kept that $100 in my pocket. Hand-me-downs for your kids are a no-brainer too. Younger siblings will be stoked to have their older sibs' stuff, especially if you can con them into it. Kelly, remember how fast Charlie was in this speed suit? Everyone knows how dorky brand new kit looks and how cool the worn-in stuff makes you. I love breaking out my leather Merrill red Telly boots with a white plastic shell around the ankles. And while keeping that leather ski jacket yet another year puts you out of fashion, the planet will thank you. There's a pretty cool dude named Yvonne Chouinard who will tell you the same thing. And for the counterpart, I'll take Safety and Comfort, Thank You Very Much by Kelly Klein, Outside Associate Gear Editor. First things first, I'm not a proponent of new crap for the sake of new crap. I've written on the merits of used gear, and hidden thrift shops is one of my favorite leisure activities. But there comes a time when using the same old gear is a safety hazard that could be detrimental to my time outdoors. Take tour bindings. My dad is a really good telly skier, and he uses that gear, much of it made in the previous century, to ski with me in the backcountry. I have no beef with tally skiing, but he refuses to spring for a touring setup. He does not have the option to ski with his heels locked down the way I can with my hybrid shifts. The latter offer better versatility and control, and I believe I'm a safer skier for it. And those duct tape gloves? They look pretty badass, I will admit, but my Hestress keep my fingers much warmer. Already concede that my dad looks cooler than me in his vintage gear, regardless of what shape it's in. Though, if you'd asked me who came out ahead when I was a teenager on the freeride team, you would have gotten a very different answer. And no, I don't think you need to buy new stuff every season. That's just wasteful. But if old gear is going to hold me back or jeopardize my safety, that's not a trade-off I'm willing to make. And while we're at it, Dad, I didn't hear any complaints when you unwrapped those sweet Smith sunglasses last Christmas. So that's the debate about old gear versus new gear. And next up from Dispatches is Deer Gear. Deer Gear, I've been a confident skier, mountain biker, and climber for over 3 decades. I'm also a woman. For some reason, most of the guys in my life seem to think it's okay to mansplain how to use my gear to me. And it makes me want to scream. What's the best way to handle this situation so I don't blow a gasket? Frustrated feminist. Dear Frustrated, first of all, do you know what a blowing a gasket actually means? I'd be happy to explain it to you. I'm kidding. All the scouts have been in your shoes at one time or another. While the outdoors are far less biased than they used to be, there's work to be done when it comes to educating menfolk on how not to educate women. Unfortunately, as I've discovered, an explosive, curse-filled rant isn't the most effective route to the enlightenment, although it's plenty cathartic. Usually the dude just ends up getting defensive. For me, 2 strategies have brought the most success. Option 1. Play dumb. Now your first reaction might be, isn't that exactly what the mansplainer wants me to do? But I'm talking so dumb that you can cause utter confusion until the mansplainer finally sees how ridiculous he's being. For example, if a man were to tell me, a skier gi editor, that the skis I'm on are known for being playful, I'd ask, what does that mean? And when Des says something like, there's a lot of rocker in them, so it's easier ski, switch and jib around the mountain, I'd respond with, what's switch? And so on. Super fun. You get to pretend you're a 2-year-old for a few minutes. But fear not, with practice, your reward will be an extremely docile lift partner with a better understanding of the value of unsolicited advice. Option 2, call him out. Rebecca Solnit style. Before the term mansplaining was even born, the writer-activist's famous 2014 essay, Men Explain Things to Me, offered several explanations of Mr. Important. Men narrating her area of expertise back to her, in one case even referencing a book he didn't realize she'd written. Dude, if you're reading this, you're a carbuncle on the face of humanity, an obstacle to civilization. Feel the shame. She wrote about another man. Next time you're getting mansplained on the chairlift or on the crag, tell him he's being a carbuncle and let me know how it goes. No matter which route you choose, the key is to address the arrogance post haste, because once you let a few patronizing micromansplains slide, that's when the fury builds, and once the vitriol comes to a boil, that explosive curse-filled rant is likely to follow. Although, if you truly can't hold it in any longer, it might be exactly what the mansplainer needs, goddammit. And that was Dear Frustrated, a Frustrated Feminist on mansplaining. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.